You are listening to Punk News Podcast number 264. Is features editor John Gentile. Welcome back to Punk News Podcast. We got a super jam-packed episode. We got a lot to talk about, a lot of fat to chew on, a lot to think about, a lot to stimulate your brain, a lot to stimulate your soul, a lot to get down to the core of what punk rock is. We're going to be talking about fun things. We're going to be talking about sad things. And here to laugh and cry with me is managing editor Adam White. Adam White, are you ready to run the whole gamut of emotions on this evening's podcast?
John, I am so tired that the gamut of emotions is going to destroy me by the time we're at the end of this.
Actually, that opens up a realm of two things. You know, when people are tired, their emotions seem to be, what's the word I'm looking for? Explosive, both positive and negatively. You would think when you're tired, you wouldn't have energy for emotion, but tired people seem to be the most volatile when it comes to emotion. Do you care to postulate on a thesis for that phenomenon?
No.
Why are you so tired, Adam White?
I don't know, because I have two kids and I worked all day and it's almost 10 p.m. This is sleep time.
And well, that's how dedicated Adam White is, people. He's got a full-time job. He's a businessman. He's got two kids. He's got a wife. And he had people throwing water at him today. But still, he is here to entertain you, the fabulous, the wonderful Punk News listener. And here with a guy that's got lots of time on his hands, the guy that just screws around all day, hangs out with the ladies, goes to the after-hours clubs, picks up chicks. We are here with Tricky Ricky Frankel, reviews writer. Tricky Ricky, what's happening?
Hey, guys. I'm so honored that we're keeping the tradition of me being on the podcast for yet another sexual assault story.
Okay. Well, then.
Almost every time there's a sexual assault story on Punk News, I'm on the podcast to talk about it. Well, it's getting weird.
Suspiciously so, sort of like, why does Peter Parker manage to get all these pictures of Spider-Man?
It's getting to that point. I was here for the
Kim Fowley,
the guy who gave meth to babies. Yeah, guy.
That guy, and like that guy was like the worst guy ever.
And I'm here for. I was also there for the Newfound Glory guy.
Oh yeah.
So it's just getting, my point is, it's becoming like a phenomenon in itself that I'm always these stories.
These are sensitive topics, and I feel Punk News does a pretty good job of handling them as sensitively as we can. So you should be honored that we feel we have the confidence in you that we can entrust these difficult topics in your hands, because some people just cannot handle these topics properly. Is that not right, Adam White? Is that not true?
I can't get over the suspicion thing right now. I'm Ricky. Well, I got my eye on you, man.
Well, listen, people, let's kick off today with a tune and we're going to come back with some heavy topics. You know, a little while ago, I saw this band in Philadelphia called Posers. They've got kind of a first, second wave UK punk thing, a little West Coast USA punk. I think they're phenomenal. I think they're great. Their tunes are driving, energetic, and plus, this is not a band that says you should do X, Y, and Z, or you should think A, B, and C. This is a band that really promotes open ideas, and their songs don't necessarily have a single meaning to them. Their songs are very ambiguous to a degree, at least, but there's definitely something going on. I think this band has a phenomenal live show, and I'm going to digress briefly. The reason I bring that up is they've got one song called Coppin' in Camden. And this band's pretty young. I think they're only like 21, 22, maybe 23. And the song Coppin' in Camden gives explicit details on how to buy heroin in Camden, New Jersey, across the bridge from Philadelphia. And what I like about this band is they're dangerous. They're not saying you should do this. They're recounting copping heroin or getting heroin in New Jersey. And they're not passing a moral judgment either positively or negatively on that. I find that very interesting. Though as I get older, I get concerned about that. I get worried because my sources in Philadelphia tell me that heroin is having a semi-comeback. So this worries me. I hope this band just finds it amusing to write songs about getting heroin and actually isn't getting heroin. Because nothing good comes from heroin. I think the tale of Dave Brocky should illustrate that well. But I mean, Adam White, you and I are in our 30s. Is there anything that you and I can say to steer the kids away from heavy drugs? I mean, can I get a witness that heavy drugs are bad and are not a good idea and are foolish?
I would suspect that they probably are. However, I heard something the other day that I wonder is going to have like the opposite effect on people in their 30s. And that is that, so there's a really good podcast that's out there that Damian Abraham from Fucked Up puts out called Turned Out a Punk.
Very good.
Where he goes and interviews people who are, you know, in the punk scene about how they got into the punk scene. And he interviews Fat Mike on the most recent episode. And at one point, Mike comments that that the whole reason why, like, NOFX worked as a band for such a long time when everyone else from that era either broke up or died was that he was pretty much sober and responsible the whole time. And then at some point he realized when he was like 32, he's like, well, shit, I'm a millionaire and successful. And what do we do now? And the answer was drugs. They started doing drugs. So I know that has the exact opposite of the PSA that you wanted me to do, but it just popped into my head there. Don't do drugs unless you're Fat Mike.
Unless you're in your 30s.
It's the Keith Richards syndrome.
I mean, if you're in your 30s, you probably shouldn't do heroin either.
Well, heroin doesn't wind up – I mean, there are no heroin success stories. And so, I mean, I don't know what I can say. I mean, the older I get, the fewer benefits I see from drugs and even other substances. But, you know, I don't think drinking's that big of a deal. I don't think weed's that big of a deal. I don't do it. But, I mean, if you do, it's not that big of a deal. But listen, kids, don't do the hard drugs. It really is foolish. It's stupid. And it always winds up poorly for everybody. Heroin, acid, it doesn't wind up good. So I don't know if me saying anything – means anything at all or even has a negative effect, but I felt compelled to say it because, you know, Dave Brocky passed away. A lot of other legends passed away from heroin, so there's nothing good that comes from it. That being said, Posers, I hope you're not doing drugs. I like everything else about you. This is a song by Posers. I think they're a great band. I hope they don't do drugs, or heavy drugs at least. This is called We Are Posers, and it's a great song, and it's all 3 Pete Posers. Check it out.
And we are back. That was Posers. And we got one of these stories to do, John. I don't even know how much debate there's going to be about one of these because it's hard to debate these, but they're important and people talk about them, and I guess we got to talk about them. So
I do have an interesting thing to follow up on this article. So I think we'll have a lot to talk about on this. And well, actually, I have two things that I think are interesting to talk about. But by all means, Adam.
Yeah, let's tell them what we're actually talking about here. So. A Samuel North who operated the Traffic Street Records label, and he did that as Sammy Trash Life from roughly 2009 through 2011. Well, Sammy was arrested and charged with rape recently. Cook County, Chicago prosecutors have alleged that North sexually assaulted a woman in his van following a show. If convicted, North is going to face something like 4 to 15 years in prison. He's already got bail set at around $30,000. And you can find a link to more information to this over on Punk News. So Traffic Street, the label, they released records from a bunch of bands that people know and love. Andrew Jackson Jihad, Rumspringer, Sundials, Rational Anthem, Houseboat among them. So this is some troubling news about someone from our scene. And there's a big discussion of this on the site, but John, I'm going to throw this over to you. What's your angle on this?
Well, there's a lot to talk about on this. My first angle is the following is, you know, it seems like over the past 2 or 3 years, there's been an extreme increase in rape and sexual assault awareness within the punk rock scene. Do you guys agree?
Yeah, I think it's just been more like out in the open a lot more. I don't know if,
okay,
I wouldn't know if like if assaults themselves have gone up or not, though.
That comes to my point. And I see a lot of people getting accused of rape, a lot of people getting accused of sexual assault. It's always somebody you know that somebody knows that gets accused of being a sexual assault person. Or what I see, which it really annoys me, is they'll say, so-and-so creates an unsafe space. And you're like, what does that even mean, an unsafe space, you know? And the reason people say things, say vague, and it's usually like Uber punks or super PC punks that say, so-and-so creates an unsafe space. The reason they're doing that is because they don't really have any real evidence that so-and-so has done something. And so they're really just trying to smear or slander that person or destroy that person. And I think that's disgusting because sexual assault is a very, very, very serious topic. And so to use a sort of passive-aggressive anger at someone via a vehicle of, quote, an unsafe space when you don't really know the facts or even have any facts is essentially using the real suffering of real people in order to further your own private goals, which I think is disgusting and also weakens – actual sexual assault or actual rape. And so over the past year, I see more and more of these people that, quote, create unsafe space. And I don't really know any of them personally, but I see a lot of it, or a lot of gossip, like so-and-so raped XYZ 25 years ago, or a lot of gossip that you can't really disprove or prove, and it kind of ruins people's careers or people's, what people reference you by, what do you call it? Reputation. But it seems more and more that there is a lot of actual rape happening. And so I wonder, I'm actually almost starting to turn my opinion on this. Like, I had sort of thought that the whole rape crisis that we've seen in the last 18 months of punk rock has been overstated, and that there really aren't that many actual rapes or even sexual assaults happening, and that people are just being passive-aggressive and trying to exert other anger at people, and they use a sexual assault or unsafe space angle to wipe out people. But maybe I'm wrong. Like, is there really like a lot of rape happening in the punk rock scene? I don't know anybody directly, I don't think, that's been involved either as a rapist or being raped that I know of. But I mean, this is a guy that people know. Like people don't really know the Lost Prophets guy, at least in the punk rock scene. But this is a guy people that I know have bought records from, have spoken to, were even friends with on Facebook. And so maybe the whole rape crisis isn't overstated, you know? I don't know. And I don't want to sound like a bad guy suggesting that maybe it is overstated, but if we're being genuine, I see a lot of rape accusations out there, and it's a lot of it seems based on gossip. And so my gut reaction is to say, well, a lot of this is phony, but maybe it's not phony. I don't know. I'm just being honest.
There's kind of a bunch of things that I think are happening all at the same time, and I think it creates it creates the effect of, I think, some of this being amplified maybe to a degree that's untrue. But so here's how I kind of parse it out. I've got to imagine that there is a level of horrible people committing various rapes and sexual assaults and everything else. And there that number I'd be willing to bet is fairly constant, that at any period these things are happening.
You mean in the 80s, the 90s, the 70s, and the 60s?
Yeah, this is kind of like horrible people being horrible. I don't really see how it has any it's not like other kinds of crime where you're going to tie it necessarily to like this or that social phenomenon. It's not like we're talking about like, oh, the number of like cocaine related prosecutions are up because of XYZ that they've decided to target. It's I've got to imagine that people that are abusively using sex for power, like that probably always happens to a certain degree. I feel that on the one hand, we're better at reporting and discussing this kind of stuff. There's been a big effort, I think, and this is maybe an internet thing, I'm not really sure, but there's been a big effort, it seems like, of late to try to destigmatize this, to try to like not have the victims of these kind of crimes, remain completely silent. So I would have to imagine that we're hearing more about them than we did in the past, and it's more of a current topic of conversation than it was in the past. And at the same time, when you have that, like that actually real stuff happening, where, there are actual real assaults happening and people are making kind of like the bold choice to actually talk about these things now, if it's happened to them, at the same point when that's happening, we're in the midst of this incredibly, I guess, like sensitive cultural movement online right now, where these topics are being spoken about aggressively, by being brought up, I want to say, with a, I'm really trying not to stick my foot in my mouth here, but like they're being brought up with a level of intensity, I think, that we haven't seen in the past. And it plays into this whole, the same kind of like incredibly PC, incredibly sensitive cultural movement that's given rise to like phrases like trigger warning, phrases like unsafe space, phrases like microaggression, right? Like,
yeah, but those phrases don't mean anything.
Microaggression definitely does. It's become a thing here at the university system where students are getting punished for microaggressions.
Well, no, but I mean, but that kind of thing is exactly what I'm talking about, because like when I was in university in early 2000, and I can't imagine that like the things that went on amongst people when I was in university are all that different than what goes on between humans today. But we didn't have a word for microaggression. It wasn't a thing, right? But it's become a thing, and especially on campuses these days, and especially on campuses and especially online.
What is microaggression?
I'll let Ricky define it in a second. But what we're seeing is that like those, because I don't want to get too far down that train because it gets away from the actual kind of rape thing that we're talking about here. But there's a whole kind of very PC, very kind of like new way of discussing these kind of, I guess, these kind of crimes, these kinds of things that happen between people that didn't exist before. And that conversation, that talk about it, is it's incredibly it's very incendiary, it's very, it's out in the open a lot more than it was. And that, so you have, so that, that's what I think the combination is here, is that we're talking more about these actual crimes. These actual crimes are still happening. They're being reported in a way that we're going to know about them more. And this is just partly like an internet thing. You know, if some guy from a random punk label was charged with rape 30 years ago, no one outside of his local scene may ever have even heard about it, right? But, you know, these days these things get onto punk news and everything else and everyone can know about them, right? So you've got all those factors. And at the same point when you have all those actual factors where these things are happening, these things are being amplified, you also have this whole sphere of conversation about these topics, this very PC, this very, like, it's a millennials thing, I'm going to say, right? The same kind of topics, the same kind of conversation that's giving rise to these microaggression topics and all these kind of things. All that's happening at the same time, and it's making everything seem, I think, louder, and it's making it seem like there's more of this. I'm entirely willing to bet there isn't more rape happening now than there was. I think that we're more willing to talk about it, and we're more exposed to these things when they do get into the news. And that's my guess. That's my kind of gut feeling on this. So, all right, not to get, like, super far off. I mean, Ricky, you want to, like, what's a microaggression? Because you're closer to the campus world than we are. So,
well, yeah, I mean, when it comes to the article we're talking about, though, I think you guys said it pretty, hit the nail on the head in terms of the PC stuff, but also the fact that people are talking about it more. I was actually friends with him on Facebook. He friended me like a few months ago, and I realized it was him maybe a little while, I guess a few days later, but I didn't realize it was Sammy Trash Life. It was just some guy making art and taking pictures of it. But he openly admitted about, you know, a lot of heroin use and relapsing not actually too long ago. And he also admitted to, like, you know, borderline personality disorder or something like that. And once this broke, people started trolling the shit out of his Facebook profile and posting this Chicago, I think, Tribune article on it. And they're all talking about it. And he didn't say anything. So he's kind of under the gun. But to the microaggression thing. So I'm going to read a term. I'm looking at a BuzzFeed article, but it seems to be the best thing, because I can give you some examples. So the term microaggression was used by a Columbia professor to refer to, quote, brief and commonplace daily verbal behavior or environmental indignities, whether intentional or unintentional, that communicate hostile, derogatory, or negative racial slights and insults towards people of color. Okay.
But that's not how it's being used these days. It's much broader.
I'm about to give you an example. So this BuzzFeed article has, like, pictures of people holding up a microaggression that they've encountered and been a, quote, victim of. So there's a Japanese woman here, and it says, "So what do you guys speak in Japan? Asian?" So that's technically a microaggression. Then there's an African-American gentleman holding a sign that says, "You don't act like a normal black person, you know?" And then there's also an African-American woman saying, "Courtney, I never see you as a black girl." And then it says, #, open your eyes, at the end of that one.
So with these microaggressions and things, it's a new label that we've gone and attached to what, I guess, back in the olden days of 2000, when I went to school, we would have called ignorance or insensitivity, right?
Yeah, like, slightly. And I can tell you, when it comes to college campuses, my sister is in charge of she's in charge of a the group that puts on, like, comedy shows and concerts at her college. And it's getting so bad there now. Her superiors are asking if they can censor these comics that come on.
Ooh.
Like, it's
that,
getting
that makes me nervous, man.
And remember, I don't know if you guys remember the whole Viet Cong controversy, like, that plays into this too.
Yeah.
So, I'm not kidding. The UC system, and I believe the CSU system now, have implemented and made a whole thing of microaggressions part of, like, grounds for discipline. It's kind of crazy. And I mean, I don't think, like, all these quote unquote microaggressions are necessarily coming from a bad place, but it kind of vilifies everyone.
It's, I mean, It's weird because when I was young, I had to have assumed that like I was the, you know, I was like the most liberal leftisty, you know, borderline communist person that I knew. And to imagine that like, and every criticism that I heard at the time of like, oh, this and that is being too PC or being too being too politically correct, being too, you know, sensitive to the needs of like this or that, you know, group. I always thought like, oh, these, that opinion is completely crazy to me. But now it's like, it's so weird where all of a sudden, like, you know, I'm what, 10, 15 years older than that. And now I'm looking back at the kind of thing that's going on, like on campuses in that world where I was considering myself like on the one end of that spectrum. And I'm going like, holy shit, it's kind of scary to me. Like, I don't know if I could operate there. Like it would,
my brother and sister, they're twins. They both go to the same school. They're going crazy. It's not like they're not like ultra conservatives trying to shove, you know, views down other people's throats. They just are like normal people that have like probably the same views on this kind of stuff as the three of us do here. But it's completely overbearing, and they come home complaining about it.
Listen, along those lines, this feeds right in. This is related to this. Is, you know, when Ricky was on last time, we talked about Jackie of the Runaways getting raped by Kim Fowley. Well, Chrissy Hind of the Pretenders just put out an autobiography or a biography, and basically, here's what she said in it. This is Chrissy Hind in an interview. Because apparently, it turns out Chrissy Hind was raped when she was like 21. This is Chrissy Hind. She said, "If you don't want to entice a rapist, don't wear high heels so you can't run from him. If you're wearing something that says, come and F me, you better be good on your feet." Now, Chrissy Hind was destroyed on the internet saying, "You should be able to say that. No, you shouldn't. You're wrong. You're wrong. You don't know what you're talking about. You shouldn't say that. What you're saying is harmful." And I feel as though her comments were taken way out of context, but also I feel as though in the context of sexual assault and rape, right now, you can only say message X, and you can't say message Y, even if message Y is complimentary towards message X. You can only say message X. And let me break it out for you. One of the big things is in the conversation of sexual assault is, even if a girl is drunk, even if she's in high heels, even if she's dressing very provocatively, it's not okay to sexually assault her, which we all agree with that, 100%. No matter what, no girl ever deserves to be sexually assaulted, or no girl is ever asking for it or anything like that. We all agree with that. The way the internet seemed to interpret Chrissy Hind's statement was that she was saying it is the girl's fault if she's wearing high heels or if she's drunk or something. I don't think that's what Chrissy Hind was saying. And Adam and Ricky, I'm interested in your feedback. I think the point is this, is in sexual assault dialogue, the idea is we want to get to a society where sexual assault is only the fault – well, we all know sexual assault is purely only the fault of the rapist or the sexual assaulter. That's the only person to blame 100%. The idea is to prevent sexual assault, we want to re-educate people that might be potential sexual assaulters so they won't sexually assault people. We don't need to we shouldn't have to educate young women or whoever that you shouldn't go out late at night or you shouldn't be dressed provocatively. I think what Chrissy Hind was saying was she was coming from a more pragmatic view. She wasn't saying that you deserve to get sexually assaulted if you're drunk or provocatively dressed. She's saying the fact is in modern society right now, if you are unprotected by yourself, if you are dressed provocatively, if you are drunk, you are more likely to get sexually assaulted. That's what Chrissy Hind is saying, I think. She's not placing a moral blame on that person. She's saying from a factual standpoint that is more likely to happen. So she's saying protect yourself and don't put yourself in that position. I think she's saying sexual assault rapists or sexual assaulters should not sexually assault people, and it's always their fault. But we live in a world with bad people, and you need to protect yourself against bad people, even though the other person is 100% morally to blame. Adam, Ricky, do you think I've interpreted that correctly? Do you agree with my precept that people are punishing Christy Hine for expressing that view simply because it's not the standard quotes that you're supposed to say in regard to sexual assault. Now, I'm not saying I agree with Christy, but I'm saying I feel she was unfairly treated by the, quote, internet or whatever.
When I read it, I kind of read it the way that you did, where it's definitely not the most
carefully worded.
Yeah, it's not the most delicately put, way to kind of voice that, you got to protect yourself opinion, I guess. But it could really easily be misconstrued as victim blaming. So, like, on the one hand, I get how this is a good example of maybe what we were talking about with the microaggressions thing there, where we're saying that, like, you know, there's a lot of, like, oversensitivity or there's a lot of, like, hypersensitivity to the point where, you know, people's actual, like, opinions and speech are going to potentially be, like, curtailed by all of this. So, yeah, I think that that's more along the lines of what she was going with. I mean, there's a part of me that really wants to believe that Chrissy Hine probably doesn't, you know, toe the victim blaming line of rape apologists. And I can't imagine that that's what her opinion is. So yeah, that really did seem like one of those internet things blown out of proportion. Before we get any further here, I want to circle us back because we went off on this weird, on this tangent here. This is my fault where we're talking about, the Chrissy Hine article is actually, like, it's a completely legit story that we should probably, you know, keep discussing. But, like, just to kind of come back to where we came from, while we are all troubled by this hypersensitive PC microaggression-y, trigger warning-y culture that we have, I don't want anyone listening to this show to misconstrue that, you know, we're using that discussion that we veered off into to in any way try to minimize the charges that have been made against Samuel North here. Because if, you know, the law finds that he actually raped someone, then, you know, microaggressions have shit to do with that. That is a fucking crime and you should go to jail.
No, but that was my initial point of this whole conversation. Yeah. My initial point was I was thinking that the rape or sexual assault in punk rock or music has been overstated, but maybe it's not overstated.
Yeah, yeah, okay. I just wanted to circle back there because
that was my initial point, Adam. Particularly with this, because this is a guy that people I know and he's been around, and this is a hardcore rape. You know, well, all rape is hardcore, but I mean, this is a vicious, hateful thing that this guy has done. You see what I'm saying? Allegedly. Yeah, allegedly. I got to say, I'm not betting on him at trial. You know what I'm saying?
No, I mean, based on his blog posts and stuff like that, I don't think it's looking good for him.
But what my point is maybe rape, I guess maybe the focus on rapes and sexual assault in punk rock are not overstated, and I don't know how to determine. See, a lot of people have a lot of I don't horses in the race, if you will, or a lot of people have very strong feelings about this. So I think people are more likely to overstate their position. So I don't know how I can determine which is the correct view to take, if there's a correct view to take.
The way I do this is I always look at something. I mean, like, I try and look at the circumstances. If there's not like a whole with each case, if there's not like a whole lot of, maybe like a whole lot of accusations, like the Bill Cosby case, or if we get like a more of a story, we don't really know exactly how, like, a whole lot about how this happened. But at the same time, I want to look at each case. I'm not saying each case is better, is more serious than the other, but I just don't want to have to go through that episode where remember Rolling Stone printed a story about a fraternity sexually assaulting a girl and it ended up being false and now they're getting sued. And
they didn't follow their sources properly. They got like one end of the story and then published.
Yeah. We had another story a while ago about how some guy was getting sued.
Connor Oberst.
Yeah. So those are, for some reason, there seems to be like a proportion of these false cases to the large amount of not false of true cases. And I don't want to get, I just don't want, I don't think, I just want to look at it like everything cautiously and make sure like all sides get equal, you know, say and everything like that. But other than that, no, these people should be going to jail if they are all true.
You know, here's my question, and maybe we'll throw it out to the audience. And I of course, every issue should be addressed on an issue-by-issue basis. But the bigger question is, how aware and how focused do we need to be in the punk rock scene about sexual assault? How much of a crisis is it really? And that's my question. Like, should I be posting essays about it every week at Punk News? Or, I mean, is it that serious? Like at a punk rock, if I go to a punk rock show, is someone going to get raped there? Or is it, like, way overstated? I don't know. I'm saying I don't know. So educate me, Punk News audience. I really don't know. I mean, I think that's about as honest as I can be. What do you think, Adam?
What scares me is I feel that, like, voicing that, like, I don't know how to handle this, is coming back to our microaggressions talk, it is going to be seen by someone as like the fact that you're not taking this as seriously.
I am taking it seriously.
Well, sorry, let's say the fact that you don't immediately recognize the level of the crisis to the degree that they recognize to the level of the crisis is an assault on them somehow.
But that's what I'm saying.
That's what I'm worried about.
Isn't that in and of itself like the problem with the whole microaggression over PC culture? We can't be unsure about something.
We have to
completely go with one way of thinking.
Yeah, I'm just saying, educate me, Punk News audience, because I am unsure in this scenario because I don't think I know anybody that's been raped. Maybe I do, and I don't know it. I'm pretty sure I don't know any actual rapists personally. So it seems overstated to me. But maybe it's not. Maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe it's a scene by scene basis too. Maybe I don't get it as much here, or maybe, like, you know, maybe the New York scene has a problem a lot more, or maybe Seattle doesn't.
So it comes down to my main theory, and then I guess we can go to the next topic. I want to be educated on this. But a lot of the educational materials I've seen have been very biased, or if not biased, inflammatory. And I don't know how to work my way through that on both sides of the equation. I'm just being honest. What can I say? If I've said the wrong thing, I apologize. And inform me, podcast@punknews.org. Let me know what I should know, I guess.
All right. This is a tough conversation. This is a tough thing to have to grapple with. I hate that we have to keep grappling with it. But we're going to move on. For the good of the fact that we have to move on at some point, we're going to move on and talk about something positive. And we're going to talk about something super positive. We're going to talk about Nightbirds.
Yeah.
So Nightbirds is streaming a new song. It's called Blank Eyes. The song comes from their upcoming record, the fantastically titled Mutiny at Muscle Beach. That album is due out on October 2nd on Fat Records. And you can find a link to stream this sucker over at SoundCloud over on Punk News. So, guys, Nightbirds, Blank Eyes, what do you think?
Kick ass. Absolutely awesome. I thought Left in the Middle was good. This song, every time I just see the album art, I get really excited about this. And I have a feeling will be one of the top contenders for top album of the year. I wish they would come down to LA and go to Venice Beach and actually play at Muscle Beach. That would be pretty cool. But I cannot wait for this. And I don't know if you guys saw some of the footage from the Fat Wreck festival in San Francisco of them playing. Absolutely killed it. And it was just only like a one song clip, but damn it, these guys are like, can do no wrong at this point.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I am super excited for this this album. I'll just be brief. It is all the Nightbird songs, the new ones we've heard so far, have been compact, fierce, great music. I'm super excited. I think this album is basically going to be the definitive Nightbirds album that basically is the perfect version of what they've done before. I'm super excited for this release.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. This song is just like, you know, it's like a bullet out of a gun, right? It jumps right into it. It's super fast off the start. It's you know, it's super satisfying to just hear, you know, really good punk rock where there isn't any bullshit going on with it. And to see that hooked up with Fat, who's a great label, and to see those kind of two things come together is great. So yeah, Nightbirds, everyone should get in on that. But we say that all the time, so I hope.
Yeah, but they're a great band. Yeah, I mean, do we do a disservice to Nightbirds by talking about how great they are all the time?
No, go listen to Nightbirds.
Yeah, Nightbirds are great people, seriously. Right.
Yeah.
And actually, you know what? If you haven't heard Nightbirds, maybe wait till the new album comes out, because I think you're going to be very – I think you'll enjoy that record quite a bit.
All right. Well, I just want to hop in and do one more kind of little feel-good story here before I play a song. And it's related to the song, actually. So there is a classic Canadian punk band, one of the original late 70s era punk bands out of Toronto called the Diodes. The Diodes were a great band. They've got a couple records worth of material that's just stellar. You know, this was a band that, like, the Ramones were huge fans of the Diodes back in the day. Well, anyways, so the back in 2010, the original 70s lineup of the Diodes got together in the little reunion tour. And they're gonna do a few more of these shows in the next little while. So they're heading out on September 11th, playing a show in Toronto, on the 12th in Bowmanville, on the 13th in Hamilton, the 15th in Brantford. That's all in Ontario for you people that are not from Ontario. And then on the 17th in Montreal at the Pop Montreal Festival. Now, these shows are special for a couple reasons. So you have the reunited Diodes, of course, playing them. You also have a couple members of Teenage Head that are playing. One member of Teenage Head that's playing. So Gordy Lewis, who is the bassist of Teenage Head, he's going to be touring with them and playing as well. And these shows are also going to have a screening of the original 1977 16mm documentary Crash and Burn. Now, Crash and Burn was it was an experimental film that was put together by a Canadian filmmaker named Ross McLaren. And it was... It chronicled the Crash and Burn Club, which was a club that was in Toronto back in the early punk era. And this show, the film features footage of the Dead Boys, of Teenage Head, of the Boyfriends, and of the Diodes. So they're screening this this film. There's a performance from member Teenage Head. There's a performance in the Diodes. If you want some classic, you know, late 70s era punk goodness live on tour, this is it. So you should go see it if you can. I'm gonna play a song from the Diodes. If you are into Canadian music at all, this is just like an absolute stone cold classic. Everyone knows this one. I'm not gonna try to do anything adventurous with this. So this is the Diodes. This is the song Tired of Waking Up Tired, and you should check it out, and you can, because here it is.
Waking up tired.
And we're back, and that was the Diodes. I gotta say, that early wave of Canadian punk really is pretty good. There's the Stupid, the Diodes, the Vile Tones. A lot of great bands in there, Adam White. A lot of great bands.
There's a lot of cool stuff that was going on back in that era. Cool stuff out of Vancouver, cool stuff out of Toronto. It was an interesting time.
And, you know, it's an interesting time right now because Tyler, the creator of Odd Future Wolfgang Kill, which I think is kind of falling apart these days, was banned from the UK. Basically, he actually flew to the UK to do like 5 or 6 shows there, and they didn't let him in the country. They actually flew him back to New York, I think. And here's why the United Kingdom's Home Office, here's what they had to say. Coming to the UK is a privilege, and we expect those who come here to respect our shared values. The Home Secretary has the power to exclude an individual if she considers that his or her presence in the UK is not conducive to the public good or if their exclusion is justified on public policy grounds, which essentially just says we don't let him in because we don't like him. The weird part is they justified his banning on lyrics that he wrote from 2008 and 2009. And in case you don't know, Odd Future Wolfgang Kill was kind of a sensation in 2008, 2009, 2010 because it's very unique sounding rap, but they've got a lot of very violent lyrics, a lot of lyrics about rape, a lot of lyrics about beating people. A band with a lot of dicey topics in it, a hip-hop group rather. So he was banned. So he was banned for lyrics from 2009, 2008, 2010. But he was just in the UK 3 months ago touring, and he's been in the UK many, many times. So it's weird that he got banned now. And so I guess the first question is, and to Adam White, well, actually, Adam White, you can take this how you like, but I get very nervous when one of the world's powers, England, the UK, starts banning on people on speech alone. I get very nervous when I see that. Very nervous. Even if what they say is hateful.
Yeah, so there's so many angles that we can take in a story like this. So I want to establish one thing first, and then I'll give you my opinion on this. So the thing I want to establish first is you Americans and your First Amendments and your things like that. The one thing that we always see pop up when we see these kind of stories about like censorship, but kind of on international stages, is Americans will jump in with their First Amendment thing, and that is such. And I'm not criticizing this, by the way, but that is such a strong intrinsic part of the American identity.
Oh, I was just simply about to say that.
It simply doesn't exist in the same facet in other places in the world, even places that you would consider to be like, you know, Western democracies. Like, you know, in Canada, we have pretty much similar speech laws to what goes on in the States, and you can pretty much say something in Canada that you could say in the States, and there'd be the same consequence or lack thereof of doing it. However, we don't have, you know, while we have laws on the books that sound a lot like the First Amendment, we don't have one that is presented in such a like foundational document of our culture way as you guys. I mean, just even the name of it, it's the First Amendment,
first,
right? Like
first clause of the First Amendment,
right? Like
it is the most important thing the founders wanted to put in the Constitution.
Exactly. And in Canada and in the UK and other places that, you know, have very similar legal systems, but don't have the same consecrated founding documents that we have on their glass somewhere. Like that's a very strictly American thing. So there's no one in necessarily outside of the States that while we all grapple with these same speech issues, we're not necessarily treating them with the same level of sacrosanct as you guys do, just because like it's just not culturally, it's not the First Amendment in Canada. Like for us, that's like, I don't even know in Canadian law, like what the clause of what document is that defines this kind of stuff for us. Now, at that same moment, there is a bigger gray area in different countries about what's considered hate speech, what's considered, you know, provocative and incendiary and like potentially, you know, bad for the public good, what the public good is. So it gets very fuzzy as you start talking about like international countries and stuff like that. So I want to just like, I wanted just to come in and voice that first, where this isn't really a First Amendment issue because we're outside of that jurisdiction.
Yeah.
But so let me come back and actually give an opinion on this thing then. This type of thing, and I don't know about the UK, but this kind of thing comes up, it seems like, in Canada quite a bit. And I know that it tends to be, for whatever reason, it tends to be people in hip hop that this always seems to crop up against. But I don't know if any of these examples I'm going to cite are necessarily things that became an actual exclusion, or if they were just petitions that people had out. But I know that at one point, you know, like they were trying to make it so that I think 50 Cent couldn't come to Canada for whatever reason. I remember back when Eminem was first, you know, had a lot of lyrics out there that seemed like violent against women. There was, you know, they were trying to get Eminem banned from coming to Canada. That kind of thing comes up a lot. Most recently in the news here, there is I don't even know his name and I don't care. And he's one of these like scumbag pickup artist people.
Oh yeah, like
Tucker Max.
Probably him.
How do you know these people? This off the.
Because we care about freedom of speech, Adam. That's why.
Tucker Max's books, like, are some of the funniest things. I mean, he's
like
also,
that guy? I hate that guy.
The books are hysterical.
Oh, I don't
like
that at all.
But he does a podcast where he does a pickup artist, and it's kind of sleazy. Keep going.
One of these high profile shitbag pickup artists was trying to come to Canada to do some sort of seminar presentation somewhere. And just recently there was a big thing in the news where, you know, some concerned group of people was trying to get some government body to deny him that. Right. So that kind of thing, I always hear about it in the Canadian context. I never hear how successful it actually is. I feel like it's always up here. It makes good news. So there's always a lot of, like, you know, there's a lot of noise and smoke about it when it's about to happen. But then I don't think any of these bans ever actually happen here. This one from the UK, for Tyler, the Creator, sounds like it actually happened. He actually got turned around. So I guess that's a level past that. My worry with any of these things are, I don't think the people that are wielding these laws are in and of themselves trying to do evil.
I do.
I think that, like, a lot of them, I think that, like, to themselves, I think that they have justified to themselves, like, why it's not good for these people to, you know, come into the country and to do their thing. And I can totally see why, like, you know, it's maybe bad for a segment of society to have some shitbag pickup artist come in and try to, you know, teach people how to be horrible. And so I get that. And I get why maybe, you know, if there was an artist out there that had, you know, a message that was particularly incendiary, that it could actually incite violence against women, I could see why it would seem like a good idea to prevent them from coming in. Like, I can sympathize with, I think, where they're coming from. The problem is that it's too vague a tool to be wielded by a government, if you ask me. Like, if you're a shitbag and you're going to come into the country and you want to perform, I think that you as the public should absolutely go and pressure, by all means, pressure the venue, pressure the promoters, pressure the sponsors of these things to go, hey, you're supporting a shitbag, maybe you shouldn't do that. In the same way that, you know, people were canceling Bill Cosby events, right? And that's fine. That's people's, like, it's people's right to, you know, get up and be angry about something. I think it's a lot more problematic if you go to the government and you say, the government, can you prevent this person from even, you know, walking into the country? Because, you know, even if it seems like it's one of these things that no one is going to argue against. So even if it's, you know, if it's a neo-Nazi coming into the country for a book tour, right, where no one in their right mind, as part of, like, you know, respectable civil society, is going to argue that that person has a valid viewpoint that they're going to come in and do. You give that tool to the government, and then suddenly you get one of these people that they exist in a gray area. And then the government has the power then to go make that call. So you get someone here like Tyler, the Creator, where you say, okay, they've got a whole bunch of, you know, really troubling lyrics, but lyrics that he wrote when he was what, like 18, 19?
Yeah.
And, you know, put out on records, you know, 7 or 8 years ago. So, and you look at him and you say, well, is that something that he did believe, or is that something that he no longer believes, or is that something that was an act, or is that whatever? There's enough gray area there where I'd want to say, you know what, I'd much rather leave that up to, you know, all the private organizations that would actually be involved with this person to make a call over whether they want to be involved with him, and not have someone just go petition the government to go make that decision for us. And again, I keep saying things on this show that make the, you know, the university socialist Adam go, what are you talking about? Don't advocate the free market. But here I am advocating the free market. I am.
That's right? What happens when you become a businessman, Adam.
When you become, right? Yeah. All of a sudden I'm a fucking libertarian, right? Great. But yeah, no, it scares me to have governments making these decisions, and that's my line on this.
I just want to say, I before I start on this, I think I was wrong about Tucker Max being, I don't think that was right, Tucker Max being banned from Canada. I think it might have been someone else. There are a lot of other sociopathic, I'm sure.
I'm surprised you like that guy's books, Ricky. I don't like that guy at all.
I don't like him, but I when I was immature and, you know, in my teenage years, I thought the books were funny. But anyway,
he just seems so mean. He's so mean.
Oh, that's exactly right. Yeah,
I don't like mean people.
He's a mean person. But anyway, but I don't think it was him. Anyway, you know, speaking to the First Amendment thing that Adam was talking about, I was about to say the same thing. Just because, you know, we Americans, you know, talk about our First Amendment rights to free speech, doesn't mean just another even Western country will necessarily take the same steps. It's kind of intrusive, almost arrogant to think that way. Even if they are a freer Western culture. So when it comes to another country banning someone, I pay attention to it, but do I necessarily say they're wrong? I don't feel like it's up to me, someone who's in a on the other side of the world, to tell them how to live and who to let in and who not to let in. If it happens here though, yeah, I'm gonna be worried. So I mean, and it's not like America has such a great record, especially when it comes to musical artists, you know, being allowed to play here. I mean, we had the whole PMRC thing in the late 80s. And I mean, if you look back, the Sex Pistols were supposed to play shows on the East Coast and had to cancel them because they were denied visas here and had to start weren't able to start their tour until the Atlanta date in the South. And they're eventually finished. So I
think the real story behind that though is actually Malcolm McLaren screwed up the visas. I think that's the real story.
Well, I mean, I've also read that people they just didn't want them there because of the subject matter of the songs.
I think that's Malcolm McLaren spinning.
Was honestly. It?
Yeah. Anyway,
well, so we had the PMRC anyway, and they screwed a lot of things
down,
up.
And we destroyed it.
We still have those parental advisory things.
Yeah, but that don't mean jack shit. My point is this. I will say the UK is wrong. I'll say it. The UK is wrong to ban Tyler, the Creator. It's very scary when you have a governmental entity or any entity making qualitative decisions for you with regards to art, particularly, but any subject matter. Art is so nebulous, so amorphous. Just because someone is portraying a bad guy on a record doesn't mean he is the bad guy. Don't insult me, government, by trying to make that decision for me. Let me interpret the art how I will interpret it. Using this Tyler, the Creator rule, that means we have to ban a lot of Neil Young songs, because a lot of Neil Young songs are from the perspective of the racist. We all know Neil Young's not racist. We know he just finds it interesting and rewarding and valuable and educational to portray that perspective, so perhaps we can learn about that person. Further, I find it baffling, how a lot of liberal, a lot of left-wing people now are trying to ban, like left-wing people tried to ban Tyler, the Creator from Australia. You know, in America, you know, when you have guys that have nasty lyrics or whatever. The first people there to protest are the left-wing people. In the 80s, it was the exact opposite. It was, you know, in the 60s, George Carlin and the other guy, was it Hubert Selby Jr.? And who's the other? Oh, I can't remember the other guy that they tried to fight with obscenity. All the in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the artists fought so strongly to be able to say what they wanted to say, to be able to express the art they wanted to say. And now we are just completely going backwards. Now it's the left wing, the liberal people, that are trying to censor artists, to say that artists shouldn't be able to say certain things, that it makes me sick, and it makes me worried, and it makes me frightened. There's a quote: "The reason people censor people isn't because they think what they say is wrong, it's because what they say is right." No, I'm not saying what Tyler, the Creator, is saying is right, but I'm saying censoring people is dangerous. It is an extremely slippery slope for a government to start censoring people, because like Adam White said, well, okay, they censor the guy that talks about beating people. How about the guy that talks about being beat? How about the guy that talks about heading the government? How about the guy that talks about this or that or the lady? It's so slippery and too much of a gray area, and it's dangerous. And it sickens me that liberal and left-wing people don't respect other people enough to entrust that they'll be intelligent enough to make their own decisions when it comes to edgy, dangerous art. You know, if somebody says something that's bad, don't try to censor them. You're an asshole. If someone says something that's bad, counteract and say, here's why this person doesn't know what they're talking about or why they're wrong. Don't try to censor people. It is time after time after time, history has shown it leads to doom and destruction and control, and that's not what punk rock is about. Punk rock is not about being controlled by outside forces, and for some reason people seem to be throwing themselves into the grasp of control when it comes to speech. Liberal people particularly, I don't know why, and when I see things like this, it frightens me horribly, terribly. Free speech, Adam talked about how other nations don't have the concept of free speech that America has. I think they should. I think free speech is the power. Free speech is the right from which all other rights spring from. Because if you can't say what you want to say, if you can't express what you want to express, how can you change anything else? Because all communication, all rules, anything comes from the ability of expression. And if you put chains on that, that means you essentially chain every other thing. And so it's extremely dangerous to ban somebody on speech. If you don't like what they're saying, then say you don't like what they're saying and create your own speech about how you don't like what they're saying. To censor people is disgusting, and it really just goes to show that if you're trying to control what someone else says, even what they're saying is horrible, then you are a vile person because you don't feel secure enough that what you believe is stronger than the other message. That's what I'm saying.
And I think it's important to differentiate here between like censorship, where it's actually the government that's making that call, and you know, you would say like a private citizen or as a private organization or something like that.
Well, actually, that is still technically censorship is not limited to government. I was speaking loosely. There's governmental censorship and private censorship.
Well, no, but I mean, like let's say you run a club and you don't want Tyler the Creator to play your club. I think that at that point you don't have to let Tyler the Creator play your club. Like you making that decision to not support that is as much your right to speech as, you know, his is to go say it. Like you aren't required to enable him. I think as the government, though, you shouldn't be stepping in and making that decision for people.
I agree 100%.
Yeah. So anyways, I don't know. That's another difficult thing that we had to wrestle with on this show. Let's move on to something weird. Ricky.
Oh, this is cool, man. I'm excited about this. This will be quick.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sorry. I my browser just crashed.
Ricky.
Aqua Teen Hunger Force just had their last show. Adam, Ricky, do you guys ever watch Aqua Teen Hunger Force?
I did, but I only turned it on because I was waiting for Metalocalypse to come on.
Adam, what, you ever seen Aqua Teen Hunger Force?
I have seen it. I kind of get what people get out of it, but it's one of those things that I'm pretty sure I am too old for.
Yeah, I mean, watch. I mean, it became popular when we were in college. Like, we were the target audience for this show, you know? But, I mean, Aqua Teen Hunger Force, if you haven't seen it, it's an Adult Swim show. It's really weird and surreal. Most episodes don't make any sense at all. It's very strange. They just had their final episode, and in their final episode, they had Patti Smith singing kind of, I don't know if it was the closing song, but a song in it. And I just thought this was delightful and hilarious, having Patti Smith, this, you know, art punk, art rock legend, singing about a meatball, a milkshake, and French fries dying. And I just thought it was great, and you should check it out. That's all I have to say. I think Patti Smith is probably an underappreciated artist, in that she has some very, very serious, very, very artistic songs. Check out her album Horses. Check out Radio Ethiopia. Check out the one with Pissing in the River. I think that's Radio Ethiopia. She's got a check out Wave. She's got a lot of them. Patti Smith has some amazing, amazing art, but she's not so serious that she can't, like, you know, do silly stuff too. And it just goes to show that a great artist can do extremely serious stuff and extremely silly stuff, and it all seems genuine. And I just thought this was a funny song. I love this. I think Patti Smith is cool.
I thought this is super weird. Yeah,
I thought it was an interesting choice for her to do it, because I wonder what the if the demographic audience for this show knows who Patti Smith is.
They might. I mean, the show's like over 10 years old, I think. I don't know. Maybe. I mean, college crowds generally know their music, and Patti Smith's Horses is a college rock album, if you will. So they might know who Patti Smith is. Adam, have you ever heard Horses, the album?
John, I love Horses.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Horses is actually one of my favorite records from that era. The entire thing is just super gripping to me. I think it's just a remarkable record. I have not explored a lot of Patti Smith's stuff post that.
Me neither. So, but Adam, I just checked it out. I had Horses for like 4 or 5 years, and I only listened to Horses. I was at Princeton Record Exchange up in Princeton. They had all her CDs for $3 each. I bought them. Adam, the 3 or 4 ones after Horses, they're all almost as good as Horses. They're really, really good records.
But here's the thing about Patti Smith that I want people to go check out if they haven't heard this.
And Horses.
Horses, of course. But Horses is a fucking classic.
Of course,
yeah. No, everyone in the punk rock world should own a copy of Horses. But when I was young and getting into punk, and, you know, not as immersed in it as I was, I was listening to it may have been an episode of The Ongoing History of New Music, which is a show that a pretty famous Canadian radio host named Alan Cross did up here in Canada on the Edge radio station out of Toronto. But anyways, it might have been Ongoing History. But anyways, on the show, they played the song Piss Factory.
Ah.
Have you heard Piss Factory?
That's a much later song, isn't it?
No, earlier.
Oh. That's on her demo cut. If you buy Patti Smith's Greatest Hits on the second CD, which is like demos, I think it's on that. I don't think I have heard that song.
Piss Factory was so the very first thing that Patti Smith ever released was she released a cover of like the classic Hey Joe, right? So she covers Hey Joe, and everyone knows the Jimi Hendrix version of that song, of course. So she covers Hey Joe. That's the A side. The B side of the 7-inch is a song called Piss Factory. This is 1974. It is, even outside of the fact that this song was released in 1974, it is one of the most fucking intense, gripping pieces of audio that I've heard. Like, she kind of like talk sings her way through it, and it keeps getting kind of more intense as it goes. And I remember hearing this on the radio as I was young and just thinking, like, holy shit, like this is just blowing my mind. So yeah, go find the song Piss Factory from 1974, B-side to the Hey Joe single that Patti Smith put out. It's just nuts. Anyways, Aqua Teen Hunger Wars. Yeah. Do you want to play a song, John?
I think Ricky's got a jam.
Yeah. I got a song. Late last month, Direct Hit put out like a compilation of songs. They re-recorded a bunch of songs that they put out on EPs between, all of them were, the songs came out on EPs between like their Dome Splitter album and Brainless God. So they came out with this compilation called More of the Same, the Satanic Singles. And I reviewed it. It's really good. If you are kind of catching up with Direct Hit still, it's a really good way to see what they did between those two full lengths. And they re-recorded them in ways, first of all, with the lineup was much different from when some of these songs were created. And I think these songs, when you hear, are recorded so that I think that they're more recognizable, I think, and realistic to how they play them now. So, but one of the EPs that came up before Dome Splitter was with the mixtapes. It was a split EP, and it was in the song. It was with the song Werewolf Shame, which this song has a near and dear place in my heart because this is the very first 7-inch I ever bought, and it is a stellar pop punk EP from two bands that hadn't really become that popular at that point, but now are. And I guess the mixtapes are still, they didn't break up, did they? They're just kind of taking a break. Do you know?
Yeah, I think they're like on hiatus or whatever.
Yeah. So, check more of the same out. It's out on Red Scare, just like Brainless God, was, and this is Werewolf Shame by Direct Hit.
That was Direct Hit. We're back. We got a couple other things that happened this week that we can talk about. It's been a pretty long show. I guess it bears mentioning that once again, Mr. Joe Keithley of DOA is running for office. Frequent candidate, infrequent elected candidate. But anyway, so Joe Keighley is running for the provincial legislature in British Columbia, where he has run before in two or three capacities. So there's a provincial by-election that's happening up there. He's seeking the Green Party nomination in a riding, which is called, ooh, God.
What is a riding, Adam?
Colquhoun Burke Mountain. Let's talk about the Westminster political system, John.
I couldn't figure out the Canadian political system. I tried.
Yes, you actually completely butchered the headline of this.
I took it from Exclaim. They butchered it.
Well, to me, it's pretty butchered. I mean, he's running for Canadian Parliament, I guess, in the same way that if you were running for, like, you know, if you were running for Senate in Missouri, you could be running for, like, the American Senate, I guess.
That's what Exclaim said. And if Exclaim doesn't know, that's not my
Exclaim
fault.
Exclaim has also, which, okay, so.
You're Canadian, Exclaim.
I don't know what to tell you. All right.
But don't blame me for Exclaim's. Even Exclaim doesn't know how Canadian politics works, and they're Canadian.
Okay. All right. This will be. Actually, there's a portion of this that'll blow your mind, I'm pretty sure.
Man.
So, okay. I don't know if there's a U.S. equivalent to this. There probably is. So each of the provinces has their own government in the same way that, like, each of your states has, like, a state legislature or whatever, right?
Quick question. Is your federal Canadian government the most powerful government on all topics, even to all topics within the provinces or the territories, rather?
No.
So it's like the U.S. system then.
There are certain things that in our constitution the provinces have purview over.
That's exactly like the United States.
Well, and it's kind of weird. For example, the universal healthcare thing. The universal healthcare thing is a federal law here, but how the healthcare is actually delivered is under provincial jurisdiction.
That's really interesting.
So we have to, you know, you have to have it, but if you're Alberta, you can implement it different than, say, how Ontario implements it. It's one of those things. But anyway, the way that our system generally works here is that the leader of one of our provinces is, we refer to as the premier. I think it's analogous to, like, the governor of a state. Okay. And it's to bring it up a notch, the premier of a province is kind of analogous to the prime minister of Canada in the same way that the, you know, governor of a state is analogous to, like, the president of the United States, right? Is the leader of that thing. However, we do not in Canada elect the leader of anything. So we don't. So we're having a federal election right now. There's a vote in October for replacing our. We talk about it in American terms. We say, oh, we're voting for a new prime minister, but that's not at all actually what we do. We vote in our individual riding. So the country and the provinces are all divided up into individual population centers. In your population center, you vote for the candidates that the parties have chosen to run in your population center.
That's very similar to the Electoral College.
So in a way, except that there's no weird math involved in this. Okay. So what'll happen is that, so right now I live in the riding of Niagara Falls. When we go to have an election, I am going to get to vote for we have more than two active, viable political parties, unlike you. But so for us, you know, we'll have the Conservative Party on the right, we'll have the Liberal Party in the middle, we have the new Democrat Party, the NDP, on the left. We have the Green Party, which is sort of on both extremes at different times. And then we have some other kind of minor parties, depending on where you are in the country.
Is the Canadian Green Party, like, the same as the American Green Party?
The Green Party in Canada has elected a few people on literally two or three people ever on the federal level. But their leader was just in one of the major debates, for our upcoming election here. People take it seriously, but they don't really get the vote. They probably don't get more than like 10% of the vote. And it's, I think a lot of people here have a lot of respect for them, but they're not necessarily seen as a viable party. So a lot of people will just make the choice not to split their vote by voting for them. So they're in kind of a tough spot. But anyways, we're not going to talk about proportional representation on here because that's a whole other topic. But anyways, so what will happen is in Niagara here, each of those parties that's running, they'll field a local candidate. So if I want to vote for the Conservative Party, which is the current Prime Minister of Canada is a guy named Stephen Harper. If I really like Stephen Harper, I don't get to go to the ballot and vote the ballot box and vote for Stephen Harper. I get to vote for the local Conservative candidate, like the guy in the same party that's my local person. What happens then is that happens all over the place. Each of those ridings basically, you know, counts for one. You got one Conservative here, one Liberal here, two Conservatives here, two Liberals here, one NDP guy here. Like, you know, whoever is the winner in those individual ridings becomes the member of parliament from those ridings. Then each of those member of parliaments basically gets one vote. So you go and you look and you say, okay, based on all the ridings across the country that have elected, we've elected, you know, 50% people from this party and 30% people from this party and 20% people from this party and, you know, X amount of people from these other parties. And based on which of those parties holds the majority of power, that's the party that gets to form the government.
Oh, wow.
So when they form the government, the person who is sort of the acknowledged leader of that party, who he himself had to run in his own local riding somewhere in the country, then that person, his party then decides that that person gets to be the prime minister. So we don't actually, we have nothing like we couldn't go and vote for the guy we want to be our prime minister. You vote for their party. So in the same way, so to put it in American terms, I couldn't go and vote for Obama. I would have to vote for whoever the local Democratic candidate is in my riding.
Is it ever an issue that the guy, like the majority party, they know who they want to make prime minister, but he doesn't win his local riding? Does that ever happen?
It generally doesn't happen on a federal level, only because if you're the guy who's the leader of the party, you have so much presence in the press and everything else that you're probably going to win your riding, and you're probably running in a riding that's pretty safe for you to win. But it absolutely happens. It happens on the – so that same thing that I just explained for federally, that happens provincially here. I can't believe we're talking about this. This is going to be the most boring part of the show for everyone.
This is part of punk – this is politics. This is part of politics that the American listeners might not know. This is important. This is punk rock.
Okay, so that same thing happens provincially here. So when you're running in to be the premier of a province, it's the same deal where, you know, people go out and they vote for the whatever candidates those individual parties are running in their local ridings, and then based on sort of the makeup of that, then that's who gets to form the provincial government. So what Joe Shithead Keithley of DOA is running for is he's running in a local riding to be a member of the provincial legislature, so of the people that get to choose the premier, basically, of British Columbia. That's what's going on there.
To be a state senator or a state house representative.
I guess house representative is maybe a better way to phrase it. But like, I don't know, we don't have the same split as you, so it doesn't quite work the same way there. Now, there's absolutely a bunch of interesting problems and wrinkles that you get from this kind of system. The one of them, and this is something that we've been grappling with lately, is that there's more than two parties that are running. So you could have a situation come up where you get to the end of your vote and, you know, 25% of the people voted for this party on the left, 25% of the people voted for this other party on the left, 30% of the people voted for this party on the right, and smatterings of other people voted for other parties. And technically the party that has the majority of seats that you would assume that would be the one that gets to form the government, they have nowhere near the actual support of the majority of people. And this is a situation that we are kind of grappling with right now, where if you look at the way that politics splits in Canada, we're pretty much on the left socially, but the party that's been in power here for 10 years has been a party on the right. Now, this is on the Canadian right, which is far more left than the American right. So I don't want to go down that road. But so you have a situation then where if all of those parties on that didn't have the majority of the seats, if they all kind of gang up together, they can form a coalition party where then they do have more seats collectively than technically the party that won the horse race. So you could have a couple parties team up all their seats together, then they can go and say, well, we're going to form the government because between all of us, you know, there's enough of us to make it happen. That kind of thing happens actually all over the world all the time. Like, I don't think there hasn't been a government, say, in Israel in recent time that hasn't been a coalition government of that sorts. In Canada, we don't tend to have them only because we've been like scare-tacticated away from doing that for a bunch of political reasons, but it absolutely could happen this election round. So you have that interesting wrinkle.
That wrinkle is the reason that I'm in America, because that's how the communists took over Italy in like the 1910s. And they started locking people up. So that's why my great grandparents left Italy.
If you really want to start talking about voting, we could talk about the fact that, yes, we have this wonderful parliamentary democracy here. But if you really look at the splits of votes, you know, you could still end up with, you know, parties, say, like the Green Party, that, well, say 10% of Canadians will support them, but they'll only end up electing like two people out of all those ridings. And the reason is just that, well, that support's too spread out. It's not concentrated in any one of those one ridings where someone is going to vote for them. So there's a bunch of different systems out there that people have been advocating to replace this kind of first past the post voting system that we have. For things like, I mean, the big one that everyone talks about up here right now is something called like proportional representation, which is you actually look at the percentages that the parties got and you allocate seats to those parties based on that. So if the party got 10% of the vote across the country, then they get to basically put 10% of their people into the mix. And so there's all kinds of things like that at some point, maybe soon, are going to come up for referendum in Canada, and we might change the way that we do this. But yeah, okay, so this has been Adam's shitty attempt to explain parliamentary democracy to Americans on the end of a very long Punk News podcast. So
sometimes we just got to go for it. Sometimes we just got to do it, man.
Yep.
I found a copy of Piss Factory. I'm tempted to play it, but the show's already really long.
Just play it. Let's go for it. Just go for it. All right. No flinching. Okay. Go for it.
Shit. All right. Here we go. This is. We're going to close it off like this. If anyone wants to email us, you're not allowed to email us and explain how my fumbling understanding of Canadian politics was wrong. It probably is. I know that. Thank you. But you can email John to yell at him about his opinions on the rape story.
Even though I said I'm explicitly open-minded and might have misunderstood the situation, yes. Mind you.
Yell at John. Don't correct my politics. It's podcast@punknews.org. So we'll see you guys next week. So this is from 1974. This is Piss Factory by Patti Smith, and it's great.
This job in a piss factory inspecting pipe. 40 hours, $36 a week, but it's a paycheck, Jack. It's so hot in here, hot like Sahara. You can faint from the heat, but these bitches are just too lame to understand. Too goddamn grateful to get this job, to know they're getting screwed up the ass. All these women, they got no teeth, and gum, or cranium. And the way they suck hot sausage with me, well, I wasn't saying too much neither. I was more a schoolgirl, hard-working asshole. I figured I was Speedo motorcycle. Had to earn my dough. But no, you gotta relate, babe. You gotta find the rhythm within. up to me and he says, hey, sister, you're just moving too fast. You're screwing up the quota. You're doing your piecework too fast. Now you get off your Mustang, Sally. You ain't going nowhere. You ain't going nowhere. I lay back. I get my nerve up. I take a swig of Romalar and I walk up to Hot Shit Dot Hook and I say, hey, hey, sister. Shake it up, baby. Shake it up, baby. Twist and shout. Oh, what I could win a radio here. James Brown singing I Lost Someone. Oh, the Chesters and the Paragons. And George Woods, the guy with the grits and guided missiles. But no, I got nothing. No diversion, no window. Nothing here but a porthole in the plaster. In the plaster. Where I look down. Look down at sweet Teresa's convent. All those nurses, all those nuns. Nothing to hide here.